petition number 22371, Reel 8.
John Howe, Reel 8. You were saying about their living conditions?
Yes, their living. The 13th parallel were on a... They were living in billets of some sort at Newer, which is on the coast. And it was a beautiful place with beaches and palm trees and so on. And I don't really know why they mutinied, I can't remember. I'm sure there was grievances at the time. But I think the thing is, they were a batch of new recruits that went there, about 200 of them. And the parachute regiment demanded very high standards. You were expected to achieve certain physical, as well as mental, but mainly physical standards. And if you didn't, they'd set about training you to do so. March 20 miles, 30 miles, double march, horse march. They prided themselves on marching. The parachute regiment is not just famous because it's jumped out of aeroplanes, it's famous because it was a great fighting force. It still is. And they set about training men to be combat soldiers. That's what they did. And these blokes objected, and I dare say they got shouted at. And I dare say the old sweats who'd served in Normandy and so on let them know that they were only kids. You know, I don't really know. Anyway, old Ken Darling, the brigadier, had the whole bloody lot arrested, and by mid-morning they were in a prison camp. And, funny enough, it was the prison camp that was occupied by the Sikh soldiers who'd been the police force of Singapore. So they cleared all these Sikhs out and brought these paras in, and they remained prisoners. Oh, for a long time. 6 months, 9 months. Finally, there was a court-martial, and they got long sentences, and finally the whole thing was squashed, and they were discharged. You know, it became a political matter. Now, they had an excellent battle record, and it's a pity that it finished that way. Well, that was the end of 13th Para. They played a very significant part on D-Day, 13th Para, and they were proud of themselves. They had a martinet of a colonel, and he left. And that might have been it, you know, just released the pressure, and oof, something like that. Anyway, our time in Malaya from then on was really coping with demob and playing cricket and just keeping ourselves fit and active.
By the way, had you gone to Mura yourself?
No, later on I did. No, I just knew they were there, that's all. Right, now, Mura was... there's Mura and Port Swettenham, and you know, these are significant places on that west coast of Malaya. Now, when they were planning the invasion of Malaya, when Mountbatten was planning it, they planned to land there. They were going to bypass Siam and land there. And do you remember I said that, you know, that first of all they said you can all have to leave because it's VJ Day, and then they stopped in here to get on with some work? Because Mountbatten decided the invasion of Malaya would take place anyway, just a symbolic invasion. And so he decided to use the 5th Para Brigade to do it. I think he didn't use any more than about one battalion. But anyway, the fleet that contains them, I wasn't there, but the fleet that contained this lot arrived off the beaches that had been selected. And they got into landing craft and they steamed for the shore. And the landing craft hit a sandbar. And so the ramps came down and the men rushed out into 10 feet of water. You imagine the chaos, you see. Anyway, they all got ashore, you know, but enough could swim and they got ashore. soaking wet. And I'm told that the Japanese came out of the jungle and helped rescue them. So the story goes. Anyway, they had a night there, and I believe it poured it rain all night. They were soaked. And the next morning, they went back in the landing craft, went back on the ships, got dried off, and went down to Singapore, and formed the first garrison of Singapore. And that's the sequence of events there. And we joined them soon after. So that was in the west coast of Japan.
Of Malaya.
Malaya. Anyway, the brigade was just running down. You know, the mob was, you know, they were going out in large batches. The way it worked is that you left your unit and you went to a transit camp, which was in the middle of Singapore Island. You know, it's quite a big island. That transit camp was miles from anywhere. They could not have put it in a worse place, as far as I was concerned. Anyway, it wasn't going to worry me, because I had been invited to go and stay with a friend of mine who ran an amphibious company in Singapore. And that was very good. My only fear was that my name would be posted to go back to England, and I wouldn't know. And although I briefed various people as to who to ring me, I wasn't confident that anyone would do it. In the end, my conscience pricked me, and I went up to that camp and saw my name on the list and the date I was supposed to report to, wherever I was supposed to report to. And so that became the end of my army career. However, with this amphibious company, I was with one of the most interesting people I'd ever known. I got friendly with him earlier on. His name was Captain von Leeuwenhaupt. The von Leeuwenhaupts are a very, very, very aristocratic Swedish family. You find them in history. Leeuwenhaupt means lion heart, I think. He had been a soldier of fortune and had served in every war that there had been in his lifetime. Wars you'd never heard of, like the Rif War, you know, the Foreign Legion, and the Abyssinian War, and Spanish Civil War. He had a fund of stories, and he was about 50-odd. And considering we were all in our early 20s, that did seem a pretty great age, but I found him very interesting. I'm not sure what everybody did, but I did. And he, you know, if you just push him a bit, you know, he would tell you about what it was like in Abyssinia and Spain, or, you know, whatever you like.
But he was a British Army officer by now, is it?
He'd changed whichever army he joined, that's what he became. Oh, I might as well finish it. He then, when the British landed at Narvik, they originally landed at Narvik to send an expeditionary force into Finland to help the Finns against the Russians when the Russians invaded Finland in 1939. And Erik by that time had returned to Sweden, and he got involved in this. This sort of man just gets involved. And so when the British withdrew, he withdrew with them and he came back to England. And he was very happy just being a sort of supernumerary. I don't know what sort of story he cooked up, but anyway, he cooked up some story till the Daily Mirror found out about it and splashed him. You know, this Swedish nobleman who was now a lieutenant or captain, or it was, in the British Army. Well, he did. He was. A very tall, fit Scandinavian aristocrat. Anyway, he had landed in Normandy and was captured by the Germans and escaped on D-Day, and, you know, had his adventures and all the other battles that were fought, the airborne battles that were fought around at that time. And he ended up in Singapore. He was in five parabrigades, that's how I knew him. And so he invited me to go and stay with him. And we used to go out in these ducks. You know what a duck is?
Yes.
I thought you might. Around the islands in the bay there. And it was quite nice, actually. They were looking for pirates and smugglers and things like this. I was only too happy to go over there and have a swim, a little sunbathing. Life took on quite a leisurely pace. I couldn't live that life for years. Life of a beachcomber. And what's more, there were even girls, because we soon found some local nurses who were only too keen to be taken out to those islands themselves, and their picnics out there. And it was all great. And unfortunately, it all came to an end, as these things do. And Singapore gradually became a civilian city once again. I was beginning to realise that Kipling was right when he said, "Tell me this and tell me that and chuck the beggar out." But thank you, Mr. Atkins, when the guns begin to shout. And that's absolutely true. When they stop hearing the guns, it's chuck the beggar out. And gradually we weren't quite the most favoured people on earth. So I was quite glad to leave Singapore, having been one of the lords of creation.
Who showed coolness towards you in Singapore?
All officers belong to a rather posh club. We were members free. And then suddenly, we were not. And only certain people were invited to become members. And what's more, it cost a small fortune in subscriptions. So all of a sudden, the main venue closed against us. The moneyed ranks, I suppose. The old gang gradually came back. You see, the people who had been interned went back to England, and they had a short spell there, and then came back and began to open up their businesses again. Rubber plantations and bankers and film people, funny enough. Well, film distributors, I remember. But it was a place where hierarchy began to matter. So I was quite glad to get away in that respect. But I love Singapore. It was a great island, great city, vibrant with life. And the Chinese are fine people. Didn't see much of the Indonesians. I'll tell you what, it's a very clean place. You see a coolie who's perhaps humping coal, sacks of coal, and you can see perhaps streaks of coal on his clothes. The rest of his clothes are brilliantly clean. And considering you could have all your clothes washed and put them on again half an hour later, the sunshine. That's what they do. But they have a sort of cleanliness as a tradition out there. And the Indonesians and Chinese all together, very, very pleasant and colourful. And all these businesses that opened up were all Chinese businesses. And you could go down and be measured for a suit and you'd have it tomorrow, or a pair of shoes or something like that. I brought home several pairs of shoes, I remember. I went and had a drink in the famous Raffles Hotel. Began to wonder what all the fuss was about. I don't know, that's Singapore. Then, from then on, it was a ship. Come home, and that was the end of my army career.
You mentioned that radical MP in Java. Did you come across him?
No, I just knew he was there.
By radical, you mean a Labour MP, do you?
Very left-wing.
So how do you feel now about having served with the Paras and the Second World
War? Oh, delightful people. Oh, yes, very much so. They were... you were surrounded by people you could rely on. The conscript army took whoever was coming, right? Although there might have been some distribution, they didn't necessarily want to be there, and they were not necessarily all that competent, and they took a lot of nursing. So I noticed the difference when I got into airborne forces. Every man was there because he wanted to be there, and he was proud to be doing what he was doing. they enjoyed having a great variety of skills. So being an artillery unit, they were all gunners. It didn't matter what you were. The quartermaster or cook or whatever it was still had to do his gun drill and pass out. But he didn't necessarily do a lot of it, he did it. And they had to qualify as rifle shots. And there were marches to, you know, test your fitness. PT every morning at 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. Hail, rain or snow. And the battery commander downwards all turned out for it. You know, these were things that appealed to me. And there was enthusiasm about the whole thing. The British soldiers, I knew, were very good at moaning, but I wouldn't say these chaps were. They were not moaners. They were... I think they did consider themselves to be the kings of creation. But they had to live up to the standard.